Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. Are you fed up of novels? Have you ever been tempted to cast aside the latest masterpiece from your favourite author and sneak off downstairs to watch Panorama or even Dancing on Ice? Don't worry, you're just suffering from reality hunger. We'll be exploring the symptoms of this very 21st century disease. And we'll be seeing what happened when the Guardian Saturday Review put out a call to some of our top poets, novelists and playwrights to come up with their 10 rules for writers. Here's what Richard Ford had to offer.
1. Marry somebody you love and who thinks you being a writer is a good idea. 2. Don't have children. 3. Don't read your reviews. 4. Don't write reviews. Your judgment's always tainted. 5. Don't have arguments with your wife in the morning or late at night. 6. Don't drink and write at the same time. 7. Don't write letters to the editor. No one cares. 8. Don't wish ill on your colleagues. 9. Try to think of others' good luck as encouragement to yourself. 10. Don't take any shit if you can possibly help it.
Richard Ford's 10 Rules for Writers, as published in last Saturday's Guardian Review. We'll have more of that later. But first, reality hunger. It's a book published by the American writer academic David Shields, which had its first airing this side of the Atlantic in an essay by Zadie Smith last autumn, in which she flirted with the idea of abandoning fiction for what Shields calls the lyric essay. He spoke to us last week from his home city of Seattle about his controversial manifesto for a new literature. It's written in 618 sound bites, a couple of hundred words each, which emerged from notes he compiled for a creative writing course he teaches. I began by asking him, what exactly is reality hunger?
Well, I think it's an attempt to articulate this impulse among many artists in film, in television, in music, in literature, to create work that gestures rather hungrily toward the real. That, to me, that we seem a little bit bored by, at least I do, and many fellow travelers seem to me bored by the naively fictional gesture, that we seem to want to incorporate as much quote-unquote reality into the work as possible.
So it's a work of huge breadth of reference, isn't it? You reference rap artists and sampling. You reference collage, particularly, don't you, in art?
That in some ways you could see the book as a kind of almost reading list or curriculum or toolkit. I mean, it's just hundreds of references. I mean, it's not meant to be an esoteric book, but I sort of love the conflation in which on one page is Nietzsche and on the next page is DJ Spooky, you know. I mean, I just sort of, that I'm trying to argue for, in many ways, the democratization of art to end the hierarchies by which we think of fiction as somehow a higher art form than nonfiction. I'm trying to locate the most exciting stuff in that space between things.
Now, in the appendix, you say a major focus of it is appropriation and plagiarism, which you could describe as anxiety of influence in a way, couldn't you, in old literary critical terms?
People ask me, well, why didn't you just sort of give the regular citations? And for me, the epigraphs explain that. The first epigraph is from Picasso, where he just says, art is theft. And then the second epigraph is from Walter Benjamin, who says, all great works of literature either dissolve a genre or they invent one. And the last is from Graham Greene saying, when we are not sure, we're alive. And to me, that gets at why I use appropriation and plagiarism, quotation, etc. I'm trying to make the reader feel what it feels like to be doubtful, that I very much want the reader to say, well, is this Shields? Is this Emerson? Is it Nietzsche? Is it, you know, whoever? One of the things I'm trying to argue is that from the beginning of time, writers have stolen from each other. There was a wonderful essay, I think, in The Guardian recently, actually, by Robert McCrum, who pointed out this very thing. And he said, you know, he pointed out that 2/3 of Shakespeare's Henry VI comes from other sources, much of it from Plutarch. And obviously Shakespeare didn't cite it. And we still read and watch Henry VI. And so there's been a huge confusion about art now, where there's this endless vetting, this endless obsession with "you stole 7 words." There was the Ian McEwan thing from a couple of years ago, where he took a few short passages from a nurse's diary or journal, and it's a complete confusion of what art is. And I'm trying to argue as assiduously as I can that we have, just like we have to think about genre differently, I think we have to think about appropriation differently. And I actually had long drawn out arguments with the Random House lawyers in which I argued very hard for no citations in the back, but I lost the argument. My compromise was that I prefaced it with a sort of disclaimer saying this was done at gunpoint, that I really didn't want to do this. Please don't read the citations. And the citations tend to be extremely brief, often cryptic, and sometimes slightly misleading. So that was my compromise. I think they were probably right, because I think it would have been damnably difficult to publish the book without citations.
Now, you cite James Frey in your discussions, quite widely in your discussions of the memoir. But that's slightly different, isn't it? He actually made up things that he called memoir. You're gesturing at a different notion of truth, aren't you, here?
Yes, I am. I would hate to be placed in the camp of James Frey. He's not a good writer. It's a bad book. But I do think that he was a scapegoat who was meant to pay for the culture's sins. That, you know, that to me, from the beginning of time, serious memoirists have made up things. De Quincey's Confessions of an Opium Eater is a largely fictional account of De Quincey's opium addiction. George Orwell's essay, Such, Where the Joys, is disputed by virtually every classmate of George Orwell's. And basically, that Frey is an extreme example that makes the whole genre look disreputable.
You could read this as an anti-fiction manifesto. But that wouldn't be correct, is it? Because, I mean, one of the great things about it is it's full of contradictions, isn't it? The contradictions of life, in a way.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, I think it's sort of an anti-manifesto, that I'm in no way is this a sober, somber polemic in which I think I have the answers figured out. I contradict myself as much as possible. And in my first three books were works of fiction, essentially novels. And having said that, in a way, I am arguing against well-made, well-constructed, traditional, linear, realistic, plotted novels that to me could have been written by Flaubert 150 years ago. I definitely am arguing for work that to me captures our moment. And part of capturing our moment seems to me to be multivalent or multi-layered, to make as many gestures as possible. That part of our lives now is that we switch modes sort of instantaneously. We go from documentary to confession to, you know, Twitter to YouTube to Proust, you know, that we're flying through data every second of every day. And to write the kind of solemn sort of 600-page doorstopper strikes me as a really antiquated gesture. So I definitely argue for, again, what Jeff Dyer calls novelty novels. Those strike me as a pretty antediluvian form.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've had a few of these manifestos recently, haven't we? We had Dogma from Lars von Trier and various European filmmakers in 95, followed by the New Puritans. I don't know whether you're aware of them in the UK. And these really irritated people. Do you think that you're going to just really irritate people?
Well, it seems to be irritating some people. I mean, it's meant to be a provocation. I mean, I'd be shocked if anybody agrees with everything in the book. I don't even agree with everything in the book, but I feel like I wanted to shake myself awake that I was, you know, both of my parents were journalists. I was determined to be a fiction writer. It was terribly important to me to become a fiction writer as opposed to the nonfiction writer that my parents were. For 15 or 20 years, I wrote novels, and for a variety of reasons, the novel form went seriously dead on me. And in a way, this book is my attempt to explain to myself how extraordinarily bored I was with the novel form. I just sort of needed to explain to myself how that was the case. I was bored by art, and now I'm not.
David Shields on Reality Hunger. With me in the studio to discuss it are Toby Litt, novelist, reviewer, and teacher of creative writing at Birkbeck, and Sarah Crown, editor of The Guardian's book website. Welcome, both of you.
Hi.
Toby, now you reviewed this for one of our rivals, the Financial Times. What did you make of it?
He irritated me a lot. Well, actually, listening to him, I changed my mind. It sounded, as he spoke, even less interesting than the book itself. The problem is that he's taking on remix culture as his sort of model. He takes it back to collage, but his model is really DJs. And he's not got the skills that you need to be a good DJ. He doesn't bring in the right record at the right time. He's playing some of the right records. You know, he's got some funky tunes in his box, but he doesn't actually bring one in after another in any way. And I think that's because he doesn't really have a very interesting sensibility, and he doesn't really have any idea of the real.
Well, what is this lyric essay that he didn't actually talk about in that interview?
Well, I think there's a lot of things like W.G. Sebald, which you could see as being the lyric essay form. In other words, it's part autobiography, it's part research-based, it's part fictionalised, because if you actually tried to pin him down to particular times and dates and places, it would probably collapse. And I think that there is a way in which that's seeing something as new, rather than as something maybe that's been hived off from the novel, because the novel has been so influenced by screenplay theory that the idea of keep it simple, stupid, and no adverbs and all the stuff we're going to come on forces novels down to where they don't do digression. They don't do any kind of philosophizing. They're not allowed to. Elmore Leonard doesn't want any of that kind of crap in his books. If everyone else is following him, then that kind of crap has to go somewhere else, because it's necessary crap. Mm.
Sarah, do you think Toby's been a bit harsh?
I think that I agreed with him to a point, actually. I think I started off the book and was quite sort of swept up by it. It's quite punchy, and it's digestible, and you feel like it's going somewhere. And then I found that it got a little bit repetitive, and it slightly seemed to me to lose its way. And also, I just sort of, I think that I fundamentally disagreed with him. I cited Zadie Smith, wrote an excellent essay on the subject for the Guardian Review back in November, and the point that she was making in the essay was that yes, you know, there is place for lyrical essays. I mean, I guess sort of I think of somebody like Jonathan Raban, who writes those amazing books that are part autobiography, part philosophy, part travel journal, and those sort of books are important and they matter. But the idea that there isn't a place for fiction, that there isn't a place for the reality that you create as well as the reality that you discuss, the reality that's out there, it seems to me to be kind of a nonsense, actually. He quotes at one point, I can't remember who he's quoting, which is probably something that he'd be quite pleased by, but the line, and it really stuck with me because Zadie Smith quoted in her essay, and I read it the wrong way at first, and the line is, all the best stories are true. And I read it as meaning all of the best written stories, the best novels, are true. They have a truth in them. And of course, that's not what it was meant to mean at all. It was meant to mean that the true stories are the best ones. And so I think, you know, that to me is sort of, was almost what I came away from it thinking, was that I'd kind of take his point and turn it on its head, really. I think that truth exists in creation as much as in reality.
Mm. So that's a point that Blake Morrison picked up in his review in The Guardian, where he said, Shields has written a provocative and entertaining manifesto. Mark that, Toby. But in his hunger for reality, he forgets that fiction also offers the sustenance of truth. And maybe this is actually where we're all agreed, and including with David, actually. Here to take us seamlessly from one item to the next is paragraph 379 from Reality Hunger, which looks at what the filming process can teach us about the novel.
As Stephen Frears, the director of High Fidelity, worked to translate the best moments of the Nick Hornby novel on which the movie was based. He found to his surprise that the best moments were the voiceovers, especially the direct speeches of Rob Gordon, John Cusack, to the camera. Frears said, "What we realised was that the novel was a machine to get to 12 crucial speeches in the book about romance and art and music and list-making and masculine distance and the masculine drive for art and the masculine difficulty with intimacy. This is the case for most novels. You have to read 700 pages to get the handful of insights that were the reason the book was written, and the apparatus of the novel is there as a huge, elaborate, overbuilt stage set."
That was paragraph 379 from David Shields' Reality Hunger, out now from Hamish Hamilton. There's an underlying sense that for all his fine formulations, Shields is actually a novelist suffering from writer's block, in which case he might want to take some tips from the writers who contributed to last week's Saturday Review. On the other hand, he might take heart from Will Self, whose fourth rule was, "Stop reading fiction, it's all lies anyway, and it doesn't have anything to tell you that you don't know already." Assuming, that is, you've read a great deal of fiction in the past. If you haven't, you have no business whatsoever being a writer of fiction. Typically selfish bit of badinage there. Now, Self was one of nearly 30 writers who contributed to 10 Rules for Writers, since when the internet has gone bananas. We've had 200,000 online readers and rising. Lisa Allardyce, who edits Saturday Review, joins Toby, Sarah and me to explain how she dreamt up the project. Lisa, let's get one thing straight right from the start. Whose idea was it? Was it yours or did you steal it?
I stole it shamefully from Elmore Leonard, whose 10 Rules for Writing are going to be published next month. I think bits of them have already been published in the New Yorker, and they've become something, they've got a following, especially amongst creative writing schools. I know Hanif Qureshi, for one, gives all his students a copy before they begin and makes sure that they've studied them. But then I thought, in the name of journalistic novelty, I'm always badgering all our poor writers for their books of the year, their summer books, their midwinter books, and whether or not they can pracy War and Peace in 60 words backwards. And I'm sometimes surprised why they tell me that they'd rather stay in and rearrange their bookshelves.
So you had a fantastic response to this, didn't you?
Yes, I did, surprisingly, which is always lovely. And I actually sent out emails saying, "Oh my goodness, you're going to groan at this. Please don't. I'm hoping in the execution it won't be too groany." And they all came back with very thoughtful, lively and amusing responses. So thank them all very much for that. So.
Not everybody is entirely behind it, though, are they?
Had a few people who told me they'd rather rearrange their bookshelves. Philip Pullman's was so representative and sweet that we thought we'd publish it. His main one was, "No, my main rule is saying no to things like this so that I can get on with my actual work."
But some writers don't like the idea of the whole project, do they?
Some writers don't. I spoke to a writer friend this week who hated it. She felt that it further mystified the idea of writing and writers as a sort of beings apart from the rest of us. And conversely, I think that is what has been so appealing about it, is that it shines a little spotlight onto a world that we think that, fiction is a sort of Promethean spark or a blast from God. And in fact, the writers have all been very painstaking to say, it's a job. We get up, we go to work, we sit at our desks.
Sarah, what's the response been like on the website?
It's been...
Summarise.
It's been fantastic and it's been huge. We've been sort of tracking it because it was immediately clear that this was just getting a lot more readers.
Did you get any tips that hadn't had already? Were people helpful?
Mostly what people said was that they were grateful for having the tips that the writers had disseminated. People added in their own, a lot of them were to do with, the act of sort of being published, I suppose, because the tips in the review were from published writers, and a lot of writers aren't published, just by the sort of the numbers game. And so we had lots of people saying, this is the way to stay motivated, this is what I do to kind of fit my writing around my work and that kind of thing. But mainly it was just a real sense that a lot of people were reading it and passing it back and forth, and there was a kind of a baton-like quality to it.
Toby, you're a teacher of creative writing at Birkbeck College, that's London University, isn't it? You're also a novelist in your own right. So what did you make of these lists?
I think as something to give writing students, this has a lot of useful stuff in it, that they have to pick out for themselves. I'm slightly worried that there's too much. In a way, if you just give them Elmore Leonard's 10, then they can define themselves with regard just to some very specific things. As a writer, the things I picked out of it were there are different audiences being addressed here. And one of the things that's not really being addressed, some of the writers are trying to be funny, and they are. Will Self is funny. Some of the writers are talking actually to other writers, and some of the writers are talking to loads and loads of people that really want to be writers, haven't figured it out yet. And some of them are talking to the kind of people who, that are abysmal writers and are trying to help them gently along to be a little better, or perhaps to nudge them towards giving up. Mm. And the fact is that those people who are probably flocking to this in their hundreds and thousands to try and get something, what they're missing is the thing that's sort of missing from this, which is any idea of sensibility. What actually makes a writer worth reading, I think, is their sensibility. Mm. It's also what's not in reality hunger, which is how do you develop a sensibility? How do you become someone who, when they write a single sentence, you can tell that sentence is by them? Mm. And I do think that where those sentences come from is, unfortunately, a massive mystery. And I do think that makes writers very different from other people who can't turn language into their very own thing.
The thing that's great about these rules is that for people who perhaps haven't had the opportunity or haven't been given the impetus or whatever it is that kind of actually gets you to sit at your desk at the first place, these are the ones that will get you to your desk. And then after that, there has to be the spark. But that the practicality, I thought, was really kind of handy.
Let's get on to some of the actual bits of advice that we are given. Jonathan Franson says, never use the word then as a conjunction. We have and for this purpose. Substituting then is the lazy or tone-deaf writer's non-solution to the problem of too many ands on the page. Is that true?
No, I actually think he's being quite destructive towards writers who aren't very confident, because they'll suddenly have this massive checklist of, oh, Franson says this and Elmore Leonard says that, and all these words are, all these wonderful adverbs and adjectives that are out there, I can't use them. And I do really think that's nonsense. I think it's nonsense, like Kurt Vonnegut saying you shouldn't use semicolons. All these things are a resource, and you may not necessarily want to write well. You may want to write in a way that's furiously energetic and overdone and overcooked. Writing isn't necessarily tasteful. I think that's a matter of taste. Or Franson actually saying, God, I've written some really bad sentences that use the wrong kind of conjunction, and mea culpa. Mm. Don't do it.
Well, like Elmore Leonard says, you should always use said to carry dialogue. Well, I quite like whispered every now and then myself.
With that one, he's addressing the bad writers who are putting stuff into the slush pile, who, when the editor comes across that on page one or two...
He commented or something like that.
Yeah, he commented vociferously. You think this is someone who's kind of semi-literate. In other words, that they're not focusing on telling the story, they're using a shortcut. But J.K. Rowling, who's not unsuccessful, tends to use descriptive kind of, not just that she said, and then there's a descriptive word. And I think she's right in doing that, because for her audience, the children who are reading it and the adults who enjoy the little child inside them who enjoys J.K. Rowling, they want that reassurance that they're getting it right. She's kind of teaching them how to read. It's not the same thing as Elmore Leonard, which is, you're sophisticated readers, I can leave a lot of stuff out and you'll get it.
Now, Roddy Doyle says, do give the work a name as quick as possible. Own it, see it. Dickens knew Bleak House was going to be called Bleak House before he started writing it. This is one that must have resonance for you, Toby, since you're on an A to Z of novels, aren't you?
Yes.
Currently at K, working on K.
King Death finished, saw the cover today. So
you're about to start on L.
I'm finishing L too.
So how much has this project of doing novels from A to Z affected what you write?
I do basically, with some books, have the title before anything else. That is the case. It was the case with Hospital. But then sometimes the idea that became Hospital had been around, buried, and it needed the title to sort of draw it out of the dark forest.
Sarah, just briefly, can you describe for me Lester Dent, who Michael Moorcock cites, who's so famous I've never heard of him?
Yes.
You have, presumably.
Well, I have after I went and Googled him, I've got to admit. I didn't know who he was before then. But
so Lester Dent master plot formula, yeah, we should all know.
Turns out Lester Dent was a very, very prolific pulp fiction writer of the early half of the 20th century. And he churned out all of these stories and books. And so prolific was he, in fact, that apparently he wrote a novel in a weekend while his house was kind of being built around him. And he basically came up with this formula for writing the 6,000-word pulp story, which in his words, he said, according to him, no yarn of mine written to the formula has yet failed to sell, which shows a whole lot of confidence, if nothing else. And what he basically does is he breaks the story down into four 1,500-word sections. And into each of these sections, he says, in this section, you need to include the following elements, and they will be the hero, his troubles, a physical conflict, he calls it, a twist, another twist, and, you know, so on until the end. And yeah, apparently it doesn't fail.
Oh, for the days when writers called what they did yarns.
Well, let's just move on now. What do these tips say about the writers writing them, Lisa? It's quite revealing, isn't it?
I thought that was one of the most revealing things. It was not just that it was revealing about them, which it was. So someone like Helen Simpson, who is a fantastically eloquent and exquisite short story writer, gives us just one line, which she has on her fridge, Faire se taire, appropriately from Flaubert, which translates shut up and get on with it, which is rather good. And others have, they're also representative of the type of books they write. So somebody like Sarah Waters and Hilary Mantel, who are very narrative writers, put a lot of emphasis on the craft and structure and how they get to it, whereas others, more psychological writers or reflective writers, talk a lot about the truth and sort of reaching inside yourself.
David Hare, who's a playwright notably, says style is the art of getting yourself out of the way, not putting yourself into it. And, Toby, take note, the two most depressing words in the English language are literary fiction.
Yes, there's a whole piece in that, isn't there?
What is going on there?
Well, both of them are dealing with kind of monkeys on their back there, really. I mean, I think the style thing, that's coming out of a fairly long tradition of windowpane prose and the idea that the reader's really interested in the subject rather than the, you know, what they're looking at it through. But I don't think that's true. I think they want to look at particular views out of particular windows. And the very fact that anyone finds looking out of windows interesting at all is probably due to writers and artists.
But if you're in King's Place, it's quite interesting because the canal's outside.
But it's writers and artists invented things like noticing the clouds in the sky. People didn't go around doing that in the Middle Ages particularly, except to see what the weather's going to do to their crops. The whole idea of, oh, look at that beautiful cloud, is made up.
It's a very good point. Sarah, that actually brings us to Esther Freud, who says, cut out the metaphors and similes. She's clearly not a poet, is she? She's not a woman who goes around looking at the clouds in the sky.
Apparently not, no. I thought that was interesting, that one in relation to poetry, because poetry would obviously be a lot poorer without metaphors and similes. But having said that, perhaps there's a way of adapting it for poetry, which is not so much that you need to cut everything out, but that you should cut out anything that's extraneous. So if you have a metaphor or a simile in poetry, it has to need to be there. It needs to work hard. And so I was thinking about this before we started talking and thought about the first line of poetry that came into my head for reasons unknown was the moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas, which is from The Highwayman. And I thought about it and thought, you know, God, if you wrote that in that sentence in a novel, you'd have to be asking questions about why it was there. But in the poem, you could say, you know, it's ghostly because of the greys and the blacks and the whites and the tenebrousness of the moon itself. But it's also ghostly because it foreshadows the death of the Highwayman and Tess. And it's a galleon because of pirates and, you know, and that sort of is like the Highwayman. And tossed upon cloudy seas kind of is suggestive of the fact that, you know, their fortunes are going to be similarly. So every single word in that metaphor works brilliantly, beautifully, and on several different levels. And so in poetry, what you need is it's all about necessity. They've got to need to be there. And if you've got that, then you've got a good poem, probably.
One thing that I thought was very interesting is that Sarah Waters uses a fabulous simile for describing exactly what she's trying to do with writing. It says that she envisages that she's strapping her readers into a fairground ride and she wants it to speed up at moments, slow down at others, and then plunge down.
I was quite interested by the fact that several of the prose writers talk about rhythm and reading, the importance of reading your work out to yourself as a writer. Is that something you do, Toby?
It, Well, I do it in my head. I think I'm, if people heard me kind of talking in my room, they'd think I was a bit nuts. So I've always been a bit repressed about doing the kind of acting things out. But that's one of the biggest mysteries, because it's much harder to control the rhythm of a paragraph of prose than a sonnet. And it's almost a total mystery. I don't think people have said very useful things about it, but it's something that you absolutely need to learn to do. And being a writer of good paragraphs or distinctive paragraphs is a very rare thing. Someone like Elmore Leonard, I'd say, knows he's not a good writer of paragraphs, so he just avoids them. He'll basically choose the sentence as the unit and paragraph after two or three lines, just as a tick. But there are writers, you know, Proust or whatever, who orchestrate a whole paragraph to come to a kind of rhythmic climax at the end. And that is something that you can only learn by tuning your ear in over years and years of making paragraphs.
Mm. Well, there's plenty to think about there. If anybody is interested in joining the debate, it's still raging on our website. Please do join in. I'm going to leave you with one last nugget of advice from the Booker-winning novelist Anne Enright. She says, "The best way to write a book is to actually write a book. A pen is useful. Typing is also good. Keep putting words on the page." And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Lisa Allardyce, David Shields, Toby Litt and Sarah Crown. Read this week's Saturday Review to find out about the latest novels from Don DeLillo and Henning Mankell, among others, while the newly relaunched Observer will carry the second explosive extract from Andrew Rawnsley's book, The End of the Party, plus an interview with Gary Greenberg, author of a new book, Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley. Until next week, goodbye.